I'm Georgie Crawford. This is the Gut Glow Podcast. Following a cancer diagnosis in my 30s, my goal is to inspire and empower people on their self-care journey. Through the conversations I have with my guests, we hope to do just that.
There is a plan, and believe that if you're at rock bottom and you're suffering, this is all part of your life, your tapestry. This is your story, and where you go next is what's crucial.
Although I went through a tough time, it showed me how someone could still love me at my lowest and at my weakest, because the love before was easy, but the love at my lowest was real.
So deep down, we all know what we want in life. We all know what makes us happy. We all know the life we dreamed about. And deep down, we all know what we're capable of if you only give yourself permission to do it.
I now live a healthy and fulfilled life where self-care is a top priority and every day is an opportunity to grow. This week on the Gut Glow Podcast, I speak to Damien Brown. Damien is a former professional rugby player and adventurer from Galway. A couple of months ago, I came across his podcast, Deep Roots. He was recording it from Mount Everest, where he was attempting to summit. I listened to his podcast every time he released a new episode, and he brought us on an absolute roller coaster of emotions. He got COVID, he recovered, but again and again, things just kept going wrong. Today, Damien speaks to me about digging deep like never before. I asked him what Everest sounded like, and the answer blew my mind. This is a fascinating story. I hope you enjoy it. And I suppose this story really proves that not all things go to plan, but sometimes the biggest learnings are in when things don't go your way. So I hope, as I said, you enjoy this podcast. Let me know what you think on Instagram. I'm at georgie.crawford. Have a great week. Damien, welcome to the Gut Glow Podcast. This is a conversation that I have been dying to have. I was glued to your podcast, Deep Roots, over the last few weeks. So thank you for sharing your story and thanks for coming on today.
Hi, Georgie. Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate the invite.
I have to say, your podcast, it was so intimate. I felt like you were so raw on it, you know, everything that you were going through. I'm sure you got that feedback from your listeners that they felt like they were really, I suppose, looking into your soul on your latest adventure.
Sometimes the extremes of these things, you know, expose a side of yourself that you rarely get to see. You know, you don't access that just in kind of day-to-day living, and it's the kind of the extreme of an expedition like Mount Everest kind of brings it out, and that kind of striving and struggle and hardship. And I do my best to kind of summon the courage to share what I'm going through. You know, it's not easy. Like, it's not easy to do it because we're quite guarded against that sort of stuff, right? We have all these kind of masks we put on and layers of conditioning to protect us. So I feel like if I'm saying it to myself, why can't I say it to other people? You know, so I just try and do that. You know, not always successful, but there was a couple of times where even after I was just speaking into my phone, and there was a couple of times after I kind of pressed stop on the record that I felt, I really, you know, you get this sensation that you really touched on some authentic, real stuff in the words. Like, and there was a couple of times during it that I really felt that. And, you know, if I feel that, I believe other people are going to feel that. And there was one or two particular episodes where I you know, there was quite a bit of feedback that, you know, people found it quite raw and emotional.
I'd really encourage anyone listening to go and listen to your podcast to get the story in full and the highs and the lows of everything that you've been through over the last couple of months. Just for anyone who isn't familiar with your story, I know that you trained for a long time for Everest, but and it was put off because of COVID. But starting out a couple of months ago, I know you were in Brisbane Airport waiting for the results of your COVID test to see if you could even go in the first place. So let's start from there and just where your head was at. You just had a baby. It seemed like every step along the way was so uncertain in every point of it. That must have been mentally exhausting.
You know, so Elodie is my daughter's name, who was born on Easter Sunday, the 4th of April. And I was meant to be in Kathmandu on the 3rd of April to meet up with the group I was hoping to join. So even about a month before she was born, I was pretty convinced that I wasn't going, like it wasn't happening. I kept up my training in that last month, but all the kind of bits around it, like what I call refinement, so the mental preparation, like things like cold exposure, breathing practice called Buteyko, which recreates, you know, your blood oxygen sats, you know, all those little 1-5 percenters that kind of helped me achieve what I hoped to achieve, like they went all out the window. Like I just didn't have the drive or energy to commit to them, because I was pretty sure I wasn't going. Like I had no trip booked, I had no insurance, I had no flights, I had no visa, I had no exemption to get out of Australia. I got turned down twice. So I was like, the place myself and Rizelle, my partner, left to that was like, when Elodie is born, we'll kind of see, you know, hopefully that goes great and well and everyone's healthy, and then we'll make a decision on it. And she was, like I said, born on the 4th of April, and I was in Nepal on the 9th, I think, or the 10th, maybe I arrived. So that was just like, I wanted to be present and kind of supportive. Like, I know this might sound weird because like I head off, but for those first few days, so I didn't actually mention Everest. And then on, I think, I don't know, say something like 3 or 4 days later, we talked about it and we decided that, you know, for numerous reasons that I can go or should go. So right up until that point, then there was a whirlwind 36 hours of getting all that stuff done. Somehow came together, like you said, when I was sitting on my bags on my trolley in Brisbane Airport in front of the gate. And I got my results for my PCR test, and the gate was closing in like 45 minutes or something.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And that's when I finally felt, wow, I'm going, like this is happening. 3 years of work, and it's come down to something as tight as that. And then I made it to Nepal, and then because I was late, there was some like personal stress there around that, because I was worried about acclimatization, because you know the more time you spend on the mountain, the more chance you have of acclimatizing better. And I was like, so I'm missing out on 6 days of a normal climbing summit package, if you get me. So there was a bit of a worry, but in hindsight I shouldn't have really worried, but I was worried for quite a bit. And I caught up with my group, and because I was my Everest base camp trek, that section of it was a little bit expedited, I did get some altitude sickness symptoms, you know, in and around getting to Everest base camp. And I was suffering from that for a few days, but that was the start of it anyway. And it got worse before it got better.
Yeah. And when you get to Everest, what does it sound like? I don't know if that's a weird question.
Well, what pops up for me when you ask the question is nighttime, like when you're lying in your tent. And I wasn't in a particularly strong mental or definitely emotional place during this expedition. So I'm lying in my tent feeling a little bit down, a little bit kind of lonely. And then you're hearing the thunder or rumble of avalanches.
Really?
Yeah, they're regular enough. You're surrounded by... Everest Base Camp is kind of surrounded by, so on one side you have like a mountain called Nupsi, which is about 7,700, and then you have the ice fall, and then you have the western ridge of Everest, and then it's kind of like a horseshoe of mountains that swings around, and you're in a kind of on the moraine of the glacier in the middle of that, and all like regularly there's avalanches, and particularly, I don't know why, around 10 or 11 at night, and you're lying there and you just hear them and you're like, and you're struggling as it is. And it's very scary. I found it like very hard to justify why I was there in the state I was in, scared, like with that fear of like not coming back, you know? So they were some of the kind of, what would you say, about scariest moments for me, like when I hear those rumbles, because I couldn't help but thinking like that could well be in the ice fall, right? So that there's this part of the southern trek or the southern climb of Everest, which is you go through the Khubu ice fall, which is basically a glacier, a moving glacier, and it's very dangerous. Because of that, and there's all different parts of it, you know, with overhanging ice and crevices and avalanches regularly in it. And you can't help but think that it's in the Khubu ice fall, even if it mightn't be. You just hear this rumble, right? And then you think, well, I might be, like, I'll definitely be in the Khubu ice fall, okay, a little bit later than this, like 2, 3, 4 in the morning, because that's the time they go through it. And you can't help thinking, like, you know, you could get unlucky and you could be in the wrong place at the wrong time. And especially when you're, like I said, you're in that kind of emotion, like a week struggling to kind of regulate my emotions. And it really hits you, like, and you, all of a sudden you become a lot lonelier and becomes a lot scarier, the whole thing.
And what was the plan there when you got to base camp? So just for anyone listening, just explain how you get to the top of Everest.
So it takes about 2 weeks to get to base camp, and then you basically settle in for the next 5 or 6 weeks, and you, for acclimatization purposes, because at that height you're about 5,300 meters, which is still it's still high, you know, but you've got to get to 8,848 is the top of Everest. So the strategy they use for that is a thing called rotations. So they'll, over that 5 or 6 weeks, you'll go up the mountain on at least 2, if not 3 rotations. What that means is you'll go to, like, there's different camps along that climb from base camp to the summit. So you'll go to camp 1, spend the night there, and then you'll push on to camp 2, and you'll spend like 3 or 4 nights at camp 2 to show your body, to give your body a window into the demands of living at that altitude. And then you'll come back down and you'll rest for a period of time and let yourself acclimate, let your body adapt to the stimulus you've shown it, right? And then you'll, the next time you'll go on a longer rotation, as in you'll go up to camp 3 and you'll spend maybe a night at camp 3. And that camp 3 is like 7,200 meters. Like, that is serious place to try and exist, you know. Every move you make is like ultra fatiguing, you know. Even unzipping the zip of your sleeping bag and sitting up, like, and you get up and you're like you know, doing everything, you're hyperventilating, you're exhausted, you're fatigued, probably have some symptoms of altitude sickness, nausea, headaches, extreme fatigue. And then so that's rotation 2, and then you'll come back down to base camp, and then you'll take at least 5 or 6 days of rest, where, again, like I said, you'll let your body adjust to the stimulus you've shown it. Some people actually, when they come down after rotations and that long break, they'll get further down the mountain. They'll give themselves kind of thicker air to breathe and get stronger quicker and recover quicker. And then they'll come back. Some of them fly in helicopters down to a place called Lukla. And then, and then you're ready to go, basically. You're ready to push for the summit. And then what that means is you have to wait until there's a weather window. And whatever operator or whatever climbing company you're with have weather routers or weather forecasters, and they're getting weather reports like twice a day, you know. So they're watching what the winds are doing on the summit more than anything, and of course what the conditions are like generally. But winds is the big thing, because you know, if the wind is a certain speed, that means like you're getting taught, like you're getting into territories of like minus 50, minus 60 wind chill, which is, you know, it's just, it's, you think you're going to be in that for 12 hours. It's just not really survivable. So they wait for really good, they wait for generous weather windows, and then you'll push for the summit. And normally they come from mid-May to the end of May.
And at what point did COVID come knocking on your door?
Pretty early. I was not long into base camp, and I was still feeling the effects of altitude. And we went on a, you go on acclimatization hikes. There's a couple other little mountains that kind of take you 400 or 500 meters above base camp. And we went up one of them only 2 or 3 days after we got into base camp. So I was still kind of sick from the altitude, and I was, I had no energy. Like I was like in a bad, like, I don't know. I really struggled. I dropped out the back of my group, and one of the guides came with me, and he was watching me like a hawk. He put a little oxygen saturation monitor on my finger just to see what my O2 sats were, and they were like 50 something, which is really low. So kind of got turned around back to base camp, and the next day I told the head guide when I got back, like, you know, I'm not feeling great. I think it's, I don't know, there's something else up here. It's not just altitude sickness. And the next day he said that it was already a rumor that COVID was in base camp somewhere. And then the next day he eventually tested me, got isolated when I came back from that hike, got tested, had COVID, and packed my bags and was put in a helicopter with there was 7 or 8 more people who in our camp got tested. Some of them were asymptomatic, but we all got flown back to Kathmandu and quarantined in a hotel there. I ended up having pretty bad symptoms. I seemed to have every symptom going, like, and took me 6.5 days for them to go, those symptoms to drop. And then I was like back on the mountain 4 days later. So it was 10 days total off the mountain, which causes stress as well, right? Because I'm thinking any acclimatization I had, you know, that's going to be diminished, if not totally gone. Now we're getting into the 1st of May, around that. I'm not sure the start of May anyway. And, you know, I'm going back here trying to, you know, trying to achieve something. And I'm, my capacities are diminished physically because I've had this virus. Now my any acclimatization I had is almost gone. And yeah, so there was a lot of kind of concern around that.
I think, you know, as an adventurer, you obviously have to connect with your intuition and your gut. I wasn't getting a good vibe off you in terms of, it was like there was something telling you in the back of your mind that this mightn't happen for you. Were you lacking in a bit of confidence at this point?
Oh, hugely, hugely. It was such a challenging expedition because, you know, as I alluded to earlier, I just wasn't in a great headspace from the start. Yeah. And that was affecting me. The physical sickness was affecting me, and I couldn't get my mind, I couldn't revert it out of like the kind of negative, low level, but negative kind of chatter, you know. And I was obsessing with failure. Like, you know, I just kept like, I was trying to protect myself a little bit. I kept thinking about failing and how I would talk about it, like to people, you know, this is what you'll say kind of thing, you know. And I remember one day in quarantine, I annoyed myself so much. I really had some strong words with myself. But yeah, it never really dissipated, that kind of state, you know, where I was, you know, like I said, all those things, obsessing with failure, just in a weak place, until I got better physically. That was when, until like the symptoms of COVID were totally gone, and I started to feel a bit stronger, then I started to get a tiny bit of belief back, you know. But in between those two points, I just kept telling myself, okay, like you're obviously not in a great place. You're struggling physically, you're struggling mentally, you're struggling emotionally, but just stay in the fight because you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. You don't know what's going to, you're going to feel like a week from now. Like, you just know what you feel like now, but just hang in there. And that's what I kind of kept saying to myself. And, sure enough, like I did end up coming good, but yeah, it took a while.
I'll get straight back to my conversation with Damien, but first I wanted to thank Lloyds Pharmacy for supporting the Good Glow. Do you struggle to perfect your skincare routine? Find it hard to choose the best products to suit your skin? Well, you don't need to. Lloyds Pharmacy offer one-to-one private consultations with their highly trained skin consultants who can advise the best routine and products to suit your skincare needs. Pop in and ask today. Many of their pharmacies are open late and on weekends. For a full list of services and the latest mega deals, head over to lloydspharmacy.ie. Now back to my conversation with Damien. Damien had recovered from COVID and found his way back to Everest. He was determined more than ever to reach the top. But like I said in the beginning, things just kept going wrong. And it wasn't long before Damien's dream came to an end. And so at what point then did it feel like it was over for you?
So I had one moment where I felt it was over before it was over, if you get me. It actually wasn't over. But when I got to Camp 2, felt pretty good. Camp 2 is at about 6,500 meters. I had a full rest day at Camp 2, and I felt I did everything right that day. Like, I slept, you know, I recovered, I ate well, I hydrated, I couldn't have prepared better for the next day, which was a push up to Camp 3. Or they call it the touch Camp 3, which means you just get there or you get very close and then you turn around and come back. And that next day, the minute I started walking, like I hadn't even left the environs of our camp, and I was tired, like really tired. I just couldn't believe it. It was shocking to me. And my internal dialogue was, maybe your body's just waking up, just give it a little bit more time, you know. And sure enough, the rest of that day, which wasn't long, maybe 3 hours, I was just in a bad place. Like, physically, I had no energy. I had no pep. I struggled to control my breathing. And we sat, myself and Pingju, there's a part of this day called the Lhotse face, which is this, kind of anywhere between 50 and 80 degree ice wall that you have to climb up. We got to maybe a couple of hundred meters below that, and we sat down, and I thought maybe we're just taking a break, because you take breaks along the day, you know. And Pingju didn't speak much English. He was a quiet man anyway. So I just sat beside him for like 20 minutes, and then I said, are we ready to go? And he goes, no, we don't go. And I was like, what do you mean? He says, no, we've done enough. And I thought that was the day I thought, like, when I got back to my tent that night or that day, I just thought, like, I think this is the death knell for this thing. Because I was so tired. Like, I this deep fatigue, rapid deep fatigue, you know, came on so quickly. I never felt anything like it. And we got back to camp, and I was, like, trying to kind of have a conversation with him about it, you know, kind of, just trying to tease out more, like, from my perspective, like, you know, what do you think's wrong here, you know. And he goes, I have headache, and I'm sick. And I go, you have a headache? And he goes, yeah. And this guy had summited Everest 9 times, and I was like, all right. So it turns out that it was kind of for both of our reasoning that he turned around. And sure enough, when we got back to base camp, he got tested, and he didn't have COVID, but he had a thing called HAPE, high altitude pulmonary edema. So there's a couple of really dangerous things you can get at altitude: pulmonary edema and cerebral edema. It's kind of like a fluid around your lungs or your brain. The pulmonary one is your lungs, obviously, and that's what he had. So he got flown off the mountain straight away. So it was a bit bizarre, like, that a guy who's so experienced. And he lives very close to base camp. So he lives at like 4,000 something meters all year round. So I never saw him again.
Jesus.
I know.
So who's giving you the information of where you go from there?
The climbing company, the climbing operator, they were called Climbing the Seven Summits. So they had this, you know, big setup where they had like 30 climbers, and they had 70 Sherpa at the start of the season. by the end they were decimated between Everton, but mostly COVID. You know, they were down to the bare bones of Sherpa, and that's kind of what ended up costing me and other people a shot in the end.
So that day when they announced that it was off,
yeah,
is that a low point for you, or had you been at your lowest point already by that point?
Yeah, that's funny you say that, because like when they announced it, I didn't know what to feel like, you know. I was, so the way that was done was we were prepared. My bag was packed. I had kind of stressed over how to do that and what to bring, and for it to have it as light as possible, but what foods I would bring, because that's a big issue for me on mountains, is having enough calories because I'm a bigger guy, you know, so I need more calories because I burn more energy and there's less oxygen. So I have to bring a bit more food, and often I have to supplement that. So I was stressing about that. So I eventually got my bag packed, went to for an early dinner because we were leaving again at 1:30. Was walking out of my tent, that the mess tent where I just eaten, and I got like the curly finger to come to a meeting. And I kind of got a vibe straight away. It wasn't a good meeting. And then I was one climber on my own, but there was a full other team that I was joining to go on our summit attempts. Another 10 climbers, 8 climbers, I think. So we were all in a tent, and they told us that 6 Sherpa had just come down from Camp 2. 5 of them had tested positive for COVID. There was another 4 Sherpa at Camp 2 who had symptoms, and one of them was the cook. And like once everyone heard that, they realized that was basically, because like the cook tent is the epicenter of camp, and the Sherpa are in and out of there all the time. They actually hang out in there most of the time, especially at camp too. So if he's got it, everyone's got it, you know. Yeah. And that's what it turned out. They climbing the 7 summits pulled everyone down off the mountain, even from camp 4. They had one or two guys up there. Everyone got requested to come down, and then they tested everyone, and like 95% of the Sherpa had COVID. So that was that. You know, there was no summit push for us last climbers because we had no support. You know, you need those Sherpa. They're the ones, they're the rock stars, really. They're the ones who without them, you know, the level of climbers we are, we couldn't get to the top, you know, because they're the ones carrying the heavy loads at like 8,000 meters, which is phenomenal stuff, really, you know. So yeah, that was that. And what did I feel? That's where I was getting to, right? I really felt, firstly, I didn't feel much, like I just felt a bit flat. And then when I was, I came to the conclusion that I had no more emotion to give to something like that I'd given a lot to. It was kind of said to me, and it was like the penny dropped. Like I was like, that, I think that's it, you know, because I wasn't feeling too much. There was a tiny bit of relief, tiny bit, because obviously it's a very scary thing to do. I was struggling to feel too much when I was told, and then over the next day it was kind of the same. I was like, so there was that little bit of relief that I wasn't going because of the fear around not coming home. And then, yeah, not much else, like just flat, just like numb. Numb is probably the word. Eventually I was like, okay, this is done. It's not happening. Kind of what's next? Okay, get home. How do I do that? Well, I can't afford a helicopter, so I kind of walk. So we just just started walking with there was a group of 3 of us walked out, and it turned out to be quite a nice thing because it gave me time to process it a little bit, you know. And you know, I would say I'm still processing it. There was a lot of frustration came out. I could start to see it a little bit in my actions, you know, getting a bit short with people. And I'm like, where is that coming from now? And I brought it back all the way to, you know, Everest. And then obviously disappointed to not even get a shot.
Yeah, because, you know, you've done so much in the past, like you were saying, you know, rowing across the Atlantic. You've achieved everything that you put your mind to. I almost think it would have been too perfect for you to have just smashed Everest. there's more to the story now. And do you think that not doing it has given you anything that actually Summiting would have?
Another thing I was saying to myself when I was going through this was, this is going to be a hell of a story if you come through this, come through COVID and Summit. Mm. And I felt like those couple of days where I started to get stronger and get a tiny bit of confidence and belief back, I was like, oh, there's a chance. There's a good chance now, like you'll do it. You know, it'll be a hell of a story. And then wiped out. I'm not sure. The main thing I want from an expedition is to learn, right? And to grow from it. I definitely got that. Okay, like I definitely got that. I went into some dark places emotionally. I was very challenged there, totally unexpected. So it hit me, like it shocked me, you know, and I had to find a way through that. And I learned, like, if there's something big enough, if you know your why, like if you can actually, you know, get, like articulate that to yourself while going through these kind of chaotic moments emotionally, it can keep you on a good bearing to what you want to get to, and you find the way through it. It won't be perfect. It'll probably be, you know, internally it'd be probably go quite ugly, but you'll find a way. So that was huge for me, you know, and just hanging into that fight. So yeah, like I got loads from it. I still would have loved to get to the top. I still, you know, I still have a desire to challenge myself with the mountain. You know, people say like, oh, it's been done thousands of times. Like, why do you want to do it? But I haven't done it, you know, and I still haven't done it, and I want to do it. I want that challenge. So I'll hopefully get back at some point, you know. It's expensive. That's the thing. So, yeah, we'll see. We'll see. I do have a desire in it to try and get back at least.
Yeah. And so what will you do next? I don't really normally like to ask that question on my podcast because I feel like you should just be in the now and kind of, you're probably still processing Everest and recovering. So are you looking to the future, or what are you thinking?
I agree with you around that. Like, I try and be as kind of present as possible, or it's a kind of intention of mine to be present as much as possible. But there is an element of forward planning in this life that has to be there, because expeditions, they don't just come together. Like, there's a lot of moving pieces, and particularly with what I am doing next is an independent expedition. So I'm organizing every single bit of it. So it's basically like what we just talked about, me going to Everest, but just having organized everything, the Sherpa and the food and everything, you know, which is a lot more logistics to kind of juggle. So what that is it's an ocean row between New York and Galway.
So
across the wild, wild, ferocious North Atlantic. An immense kind of challenge, immense undertaking. Like, it's the more I research it, and I've researched it like even before I committed to it plenty, but like in the last kind of few months, obviously been delving into it more, and I just think, I'm not sure if there's a harder thing to do on the planet, because it's just this crazy stretch of sea that is like has all sorts of different weather systems going on at once. Like, so you don't really have much following help from Mother Nature apart from the Gulf Stream, the current that you try and get into. You have obviously the cold, storms, hurricanes. There's a hurricane in the North Atlantic at the moment, which is, and we'll be there this time next year. So it's from hopefully May to July is when we're leave New York in May, and hopefully get to go in July. So it's there's all sorts of issues. There's things called eddies, which are these giant whirlpools that like can you the little tiny boat that you're in can get like just. Or go round and round in circles for like a week, 10 days until it spits you out.
What?
You're going forward and all of a sudden you're going backwards, and you're wondering why you're going backwards, and it's because you're in an eddy. They're you know, tens of hundreds of miles wide in diameter. So
do you survive that?
You survive it. So there's not much, it's not like a storm where you can get kind of thrown out of the boat or whatever.
Okay.
the only time you know you're going back is when you see it on your GPS, you know, that you've lost a mile, and you're like, oh, because you don't, there's no real, when you're out there, it's hard to perceive what's happening. You think you're kind of moving, right? But like, because you're rowing away, but you could actually be going backwards because there's no, like, there's no reference points around, right? It's just water everywhere, right? So you don't really know until you see your stats what you're kind of doing. Yeah, it's a crazy, wonderful place. Yeah, so that's what's next. And when I rode the Southern Atlantic in 2018, sorry, I'm doing that with a friend of mine as well, by the way. So it's not just me this time. I'm doing it with a good friend of mine called Gussie Farrell. Yeah, who's gone through his own challenges. He had a workplace accident over 2 years ago and was paralyzed. He severed his spinal cord and went into the basically got flown to the matter, had emergency surgery. The surgeon told him he had 5% chance to ever walk again.
Oh wow.
Got brought back down to University College Hospital College Galway, and was in one of the wards there for like 4 weeks, and then he had no feeling below his belly button. And then one day he got a little twinge in his big toe, and he's not looked back since then. He's regained like his sensation, full mobility. He ended up walking across the country to raise money for the National Rehab Hospital in Dunleary, where he went in for 12 weeks. And he said he was interested in doing something. And I asked him, did he want to do this? And he took up the offer. And so the two of us are doing it.
Wow.
When I arrived in Antigua, which was the island in the Caribbean where I finished my Atlantic row, my solo one, there had been an Antiguan team who finished before me because I was part of a race. And when I saw like the reception they got in their home, like a small island, of course, but I just thought, like, wouldn't it be amazing to be able to do that? And then I learned that you can actually row the North Atlantic. I was like, oh really? It's very rarely done. And I thought, I could actually row into Galway here. And and that's the seed was sown then, and wow. Now it's come, hopefully it'll come to fruition this time next year.
I can just picture like two Irish men getting off a boat and just both being handed a pint.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'd love to come down that day.
Yeah.
And see you come in. I was just thinking there when you were talking about all these cool things you're doing, like you give a whole new meaning to the phrase, my dad is a superhero, because your little girl will be able to listen to these podcasts someday. And I'm sure she'll be so proud of you. Has it been just gorgeous to be home with her?
Oh, it's been unbelievable. Like, for obviously just for, you know, this is my first child. I'm a father. I don't know if I really felt that I was a father like after I left, you know, when I wasn't in her presence. I don't know if I was getting that same feeling. And but now that I'm back, like, you know, it's becoming like stronger and stronger and stronger. And I suppose that's the love is becoming stronger and stronger. And she's just like, I mean, I'm absolutely totally biased, but she's just so cute. Like, you know, so, it's brilliant. Yeah. And she's like, she's a great baby and she's chilled. And yeah, I'm obsessed, besotted, totally in love. And, yeah, it's brilliant.
You are where you're meant to be right now. And that's
for sure.
In your home with your gorgeous family. And hopefully you'll write a book someday. I can't wait to read it if you do. And I'm excited to follow your journey over the next while. So thank you so much for coming on the Good Glow.
Yeah, no, you're dead right. I'm exactly where I have to be, need to be. And thanks so much for having me. It's been great chatting, and I appreciate the invite. Like I said, it's there.
Thanks for listening to the Good Glow podcast with thanks to Lloyd's Pharmacy. If you enjoyed the podcast, please rate and review. It really makes a difference. And you can find the Good Glow Wellness Programme over on thegoodglow.ie.